I said that I thought everybody can learn how to be a reasonably effective cross-examiner, and I fancy that I can teach how to be a reasonably effective cross-examiner, and I think I can do it in the time remaining. I have certain suggestions, and if you will put these suggestions to use, if you will cross-examine in accordance with these suggestions, I can virtually guarantee, not that you're going to be a brilliant cross-examiner, but that you won't be ashamed of yourself. You won't be a buffoon in that courtroom. Because I am so anxious that each of you be at least a reasonably effective cross-examiner, I withdraw my designation of these suggestions as suggestions. Instead, they are commandments. You must comply with them every time you cross-examine. Not for my sake, for your sake. Because whenever you do not comply with them, you will regret it instantly. Punishment will be immediate, I assure you. So we got commandments of reasonably effective cross-examination. And you know how many we have? 10. 10. But because we've been together so long, I want to make a confession. Ladies and gentlemen, there really aren't 10. There are only about 6 or 7. I repeat some of them in different words in order to make it add up to 10. Because 10 has a literary ring that I find appealing. So, keen minds that you are, if you say to yourself, hey, wait a minute, he's already said that, he's just repeating it. I know that I've said it, I know that I'm repeating, but I want to make it come out to 10, okay? Now, two preliminary words. First, there's no magic to the order in which I present them. Each one is as important as the others. And second, these commandments are very simple. By the time we finish this evening, each one of you will have memorized these commandments. But take it from me that human nature is so constructed that you're going to have to compel yourself to comply with these commandments. If you stand up there and do what comes naturally, you will inevitably violate the commandments. That is why at least 25 jury trials are necessary. It takes about that time to master the commandments, to school yourself to interrogate in accordance with these commandments every time, so that you will memorize them by the end of the session today. When you go to court on Monday, you're going to know the 10 commandments. And you know what's going to happen? You're going to stand up to cross-examine, and you're going to ask the question, and you're going to say to yourself, my God, that violates every single commandment. One question violates all 10, but you can't help yourself. It comes out that way, and there's just nothing you can do about it. So you practice, and you practice, and you practice, and you mark my words. Give it 25 trials or so, and it'll be second nature. You almost won't have to think about it. All right, so much by way of introduction. Let's go to work. First commandment, be brief. That's it. Short, succinct. Remember, cross-examination, unless you are Clarence Darrow, unless you are Max Steuer, cross-examination for the rest of us, however, is a commando raid. It's not the invasion of Normandy. In, out, that's the whole idea. Right? Using the word point to describe an argument that you would make to the jury about the credibility of a witness, applying this first commandment, I would say never make more than 3 points. 2 better than 3 and 1 best of all. Take self-confidence, because you've got to peel off the inessential. Back to the Garver case. Assuming that what I'm going to say in summation is just that, the shrug. You know, look at the witness who comes to support the defense. What's my cross-examination of mother going to be? One question. You're his mother, aren't you? Yes. Sit down. As we'll see, it complies with the other commandments, and it's done. And it has another virtue. If you're brief, the jury will remember. Now, they may not be persuaded, but they can't be persuaded if they don't remember it. And if you're short, they will remember it. I don't know any psychology, but I think that this is probably true, or a psychologist would agree, but I've got to put it into a picture. I like to imagine that the juror has in his or her head a sort of cup, and that cup can contain information. And when we start the cross-examination, we're pouring information into the cup, but it's a small cup, and it fills up quickly. And once it's filled up, nothing more will go in. So anything more that you try to do is a waste. But it's worse than that. If you try to put more into the cup that is already filled, guess what? It tips over and it spills out so that it's empty. And they remember nothing. You try a cross-examination for 90 minutes, They're not going to remember the first 2 minutes and forget the other 88. They're going to remember nothing when you get done. But if you cross-examine for 2 minutes, they'll remember every single question. And that's halfway towards their being persuaded. So you will be brief. Second commandment. Short questions, plain words. Again, you've got to acquire the knack of asking short questions using plain words, because in law school, by and large, you have been practicing writing long sentences and using elaborate words. You know, lawyerese. I don't know why it is that it is a custom among lawyers to speak and write this peculiar dialect of English that is known to nobody else except lawyers. English is an extraordinarily rich language. There are 5 synonyms for everything. Always 1 or 2 of those synonyms derive from the Germanic languages, and they are short and punchy. The other words, which mean the same thing, derive from the Latin, and they're long and kind of complicated and whatnot. Develop the knack of always choosing the Germanic word. For 5 and a half years, I presided in that trial court in New York City. It was before the days of no fault and before the days of comparative negligence. On the civil calendar, the automobile accident case was the bread and butter of it. God knows how many I presided over, hundreds, maybe even 1,000. Out of all of those cases and all of those lawyers, ladies and gentlemen, so help me, not once did I ever hear a lawyer use the word car. It was always motor vehicle. Not once did I ever hear a lawyer say to a witness, "How did you drive your car?" It was always, "What did you then do with respect to the operation and control of your motor vehicle?" As if he were dictating a trust indenture, and in any event, that's no way to write a trust indenture. And you see, you run the risk, apart from the elegance of it, apart from the aesthetics of it. I mean, it's just more aesthetically more satisfactory to use plain English. Apart from that, you know, those jurors may not be very sophisticated or well-educated. You may have somebody in that jury who's quite as smart as you are, but didn't go to school. And you use a word like motor vehicle, and he's not sure what it means. Now, suppose you've got to figure out what it means onomatopoeically, just by its sound. Just suppose. To my ear, the word vehicle sounds as if it means a sidecar attached to a motorcycle. That's what it sounds like to me. So if I'm on the jury, and somebody says, "What did you then do about your motor vehicle?" I start saying, where'd the motorcycle come from? What motorcycle? There was no motorcycle there. And it takes me 10 minutes to realize that I'm off on the wrong track, that there was no motorcycle to begin with. But I haven't been listening for 10 minutes. And I want that juror listening to me. So you use short questions, plain words. Third commandment. A bit of background, reminder, review, before we come to the commandment. You all know, because I've told you, what does the law of evidence have to say concerning the form of the questions to be asked on direct examination? Answer: no leading questions. What's a leading question? A question which suggests the desired answer, which puts words in the witness's mouth, with lots of exceptions. We're not going to be concerned with that. We're now talking about cross-examination. What does the law of evidence have to say about the form of the questions on cross-examination? And the accurate answer is nothing. The law of evidence does not care about the form of the questions on cross-examination. It is a matter of no interest to the law of evidence, the form of the questions you ask on cross-examination. But it's a matter of enormous interest to the art of advocacy. Because here is the commandment. On cross-examination, you will never, never, never ask anything but a leading question. You put words in the witness's mouth. That's the whole idea on cross-examination. That's how you control the witness. That's how you make it go where you want it to go. How often have I been sitting there in court when a lawyer on cross-examination stands up and says to a witness, "What happened next?" Oh, no, no! That's like saying to the witness, "Make a speech. Tell us anything you want." Or even worse, how many of you have seen this? "So why did you do that, Mr. Witness?" The famous why question on cross-examination. And inevitably, it blasts the lawyer right out of the courtroom. The melody of a cross-examination should be sung by the lawyer with an occasional mumbled monosyllable from the witness. I can sing one for you. This is the melody of it. This is the way it goes. Mr. Witness, you got up at 8:30 that morning, isn't that right? That's right. And the first thing you did after you got dressed was go out on the street? Yes. And the first thing you did on the street was go to the supermarket? Yes. The supermarket was the one around the corner on Market Street, isn't that right? Yep. And as soon as you entered the supermarket, you went to the orange counter? Yes. And there you picked out 6 fine, juicy oranges? Yes. You put them in a bag and you went to the checkout line? Yes. You stood in line for about 1.5 minutes waiting to pay for the oranges? Yes. And as you stood there, you could look out the front window, is that right? Yes. And you could see on the street? That's right. And what you saw was the octopus coming out of the sewer? Yes. Thank you. And sit down. Right? See? The lawyer sings the song. The witness does not. Only leading questions on cross, which brings us to the fourth commandment. Law students or laymen hearing this for the first time can't believe it, but every experienced lawyer, of course, knows that it's true. It is second nature. You will, on cross-examination, ask only questions to which you already know the answer. Now, that's obviously so. Why? What did you do before the trial started? Prepared your summation, including that part of the summation in which you talk about the credibility of the other side's witnesses. Well, what arguments are you going to make? Those arguments that realistically are available to you. I mean, you have to have some sense of what you can get to support the argument. Since you know what you can get, you know what the answer to the questions will be. When I say no, I mean you have a pretty good idea what the answer is going to be. Obviously, things can go wrong. But you have a pretty good idea, and if you don't have a good idea, don't ask the question. Remember, cross-examination is not a deposition. It's not discovery. It's not the occasion for finding out about the case. If you don't already know about the case, you should not be trying it. Cross-examination is the occasion for making points or getting the information you need to support the point that you will argue in summation. So if you don't know the answer, don't ask it. When you ask Mrs. Garver, you're his mother, aren't you? You know what the answer is, so you can ask it. But how many of you would probably ask a question like this? You love him, don't you? You don't know what the answer to that question is going to be, so don't ask it. I will allow you some exceptions to that commandment. First, I will permit you to ask a question to which you don't know the answer if you don't care what the answer is. But be awfully sure that you don't care what the answer is. For example, remember this fellow over here? Right, we've gone through the 8 modes of impeachment. What was the last one? Didn't you go to the bar last week? Didn't you talk to the bartender? Yes, yes. Didn't you say to the bartender that the light was red? Well, yes, I did. Aren't you ashamed of yourself? I don't know the answer to that question. But I don't care what the answer is, so I can ask it. See? But it's got to be as extreme as that. For those of you who have some natural talent for this, there is another exception that I will permit you. Experienced lawyers do this not uncommonly, but it takes experience to have a sure hand at it. You want to ask a question. It's an important question, but you don't know what the answer is. So under the commandment, you can't ask it. But after a while, you develop the skill of, I've heard it called, escalating to that question. You ask seemingly innocuous questions, unrelated, so far as anybody can tell, to the point you're actually getting at, but you know that it is related. And the answers to those questions educate you right there in the courtroom as to what the answer to the payoff question will be. If you realize that the answer will be unfavorable, you can drop it, go to something else, and nobody is any the wiser. But if it turns out that it will be a favorable answer, then you can ask it. The single best example I know of that occurred in the Lizzie Borden murder case. Lizzie Borden, you will recall, was indicted for killing, well, you know, she took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. And undoubtedly she had, by the way, but she was acquitted. Lizzie Borden was no poor girl. She was quite well-to-do, and she retained, to defend her in the murder trial, a former governor of Massachusetts and the reigning trial lawyer of the day in New England, a man named Robinson. The witness was Bridget the maid, who had served breakfast on the fatal morning. The murder occurred early in the morning, maybe half an hour after breakfast. The question that Robinson wanted to ask was something like, was everybody friendly at breakfast? And obviously he had to get a yes answer, because he was taking away any motive for Lizzie to have killed her parents. And he didn't know whether he was going to get that yes answer. The cross-examination leading up to that question, how were things at breakfast that morning, runs over 7 or 8 printed pages. Now, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you can see that Robinson, right there in the courtroom, on his feet, was getting the answer to that payoff question. And you can just see him closing doors, establishing what finally was clear in his mind when he came to that payoff question, that the answer was going to be yes, everything was fine. An incredible piece of artistry, and it's readily available in any of the books about the Lizzie Borden case. That cross-examination will be reproduced. I commend it to you. So you will ask only questions to which you know the answer. Fifth commandment. The fifth commandment is one, it is the most recent addition to this list. It refers to a phenomenon that I had been aware of for a long, long time, but just hadn't been able to figure out. But I think I figured it out now. And this was the phenomenon. Let me tell you about it before I give you the commandment. You're sitting in court. A lawyer is cross-examining. He asks a question, and he gets an unexpectedly favorable answer. You know, just an answer that's inconsistent with all the rest of the evidence. An answer that's contrary to the laws of the universe. It just can't be. The answer makes his case for him. At a minimum, it blows this witness right out of the water. And almost every time, when the lawyer gets that kind of marvelously favorable answer, guess what? He does nothing with it. He just sails on, as if the answer had never been given. And I finally figured it out. Do you know why the lawyer does that? You know why he sails on as if the answer never had been given? Because to him, the answer never was given. He hadn't heard it. He hadn't heard it. And you know why he hadn't heard it? Well, two reasons. Reason number one, he didn't know about this, what is it, fifth commandment, which is simply listen to the answers. But the reason why he hadn't been able to comply with that fifth commandment, the reason why he wasn't listening to the answers, is a perfectly natural human reaction to the terror of being the cross-examiner. Let me put into words what's going through your mind when you stand up to cross-examine. And it can be the first time, it can be the last time, but for God, yeah, this is the way it is. Oh my God, I've got to cross-examine. What am I going to do? Why did I ever go into this work? Well, here I am, I got it. What is your name? I got it out. All right, now what should the next one be? Where do you live? Okay, we're still going. And you see, you're so wrapped up. You're so wrapped up in your own psychic processes that you have no energy left over for listening to the answer. But you must listen to the answer against the possibility that you're going to get one of those extraordinary answers. The fifth commandment, ladies and gentlemen, is listen to the witness's answer. And I want to illustrate that commandment with a story. Now you must understand, this story is not literally true, but it is poetically true. And so far as I'm concerned, it is true. Right? Come back with me, what was it, 5 summers? When every one of us was glued to the television set. What was happening? The Urban Committee, the Special Senate Committee, was conducting its investigation of the Watergate affair. And what an extraordinary time that was. As it gets longer ago in time, you realize how wonderful. Here, it was as close as any of us will ever come to being a citizen of 5th century Athens. And we didn't sit on the stone seats of an amphitheater watching a tragedy unfold, but through the technology of it, the 150 million of us were an audience. And we watched something akin to a tragedy unfold, and we experienced feelings of pity and terror and citizenship beyond anything any of us will ever again feel in our lives. Now, I don't want to get into any political arguments, so I just lay my cards on the table. I tell you that I believe that those senators deserve the thanks of the Republic, because I think they probably saved the Republic. But having said that, I also say that none of those senators struck me as an intellectual giant. And of the bunch of them, my favorite was Senator Gurney of Florida. Do you remember Senator Gurney? He's no longer a senator, but he's indicted every month or so down in Florida. You read about it in the papers. I had never heard of Senator Gurney before the hearings went on television. But in the first hour of watching, Senator Gurney became my favorite. Senator Gurney was the handsomest man I have ever seen. He was Central Casting's idea of a senator. Do you remember? The gorgeous white hair and the finely chiseled features and the Roman senator's profile. And to go with that wonderful appearance, no measurable IQ. None at all. Right. And do you recall the ground rules? Each senator had whatever it was, 10 minutes to ask questions of the witness, and then it went to the next senator. Well, I realized very early in the game that the thing to do was always watch Senator Gurney. Because here was the camera on the fellow sitting to his right. The rest of the nation was watching that fellow, but I was watching Gurney, because he spent the whole 10 minutes getting ready. He gave himself a facial, and he got the skin muscles nice and tight, and he combed his hair a little bit, and he made gestures at the television director to be sure that the profile was just right, and finally the little red light went on, and Senator Gurney was on camera in front of the nation. Now, the questions were unimportant. The staff had written out the questions. I'm not concerned with that. But this is what it was like when Senator Gurney asked the questions. There he was, you know, with the profile, just thrilling. He said, Mr. Witness, when you entered the Oval Office, what did you see? And the answer would come something like this. Well, Mr. Senator, I walked into the Oval Office, and there was the president, naked as a baboon, prancing around on all fours with the gemstone file in his mouth. Senator Gurney. Ah. And when did you next see the president? Well, that's not listening to the answer. And every once in a while, in a real trial, you will get an answer like that one. For God's sakes, be ready for it. Do something with it. You will be ready for it. You will be able to do something with it if you have complied with the fifth commandment. Listen to the answer. Sixth commandment. The sixth commandment is something many lawyers think is part of the law of evidence. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Really doesn't matter, because it's certainly part of the art of advocacy. And it's especially important for those of you who have the temperament of a trial lawyer. Because whatever other gifts and qualities you need, you can be successful as a trial lawyer only if you have a certain streak of belligerence. You know that. You know, this is combat. You know, highly ordered and regulated and limited combat, but it's combat. It can be justified only as an alternative to bloodshed. So you like to fight, otherwise you're not a trial lawyer. Because you like to fight, you will be tempted to ignore the sixth commandment, which is, don't quarrel with the witness. When you ask your question and you get your answer and the answer is inconsistent with the rest of the evidence, contrary to the laws of the universe, patently impossible, what do? Sit down. That's the time to stop. Don't quarrel with the witness. Save it for summation. Because if you quarrel with him, what? He's going to get off the hook. He's going to realize he said something he shouldn't have said. He's going to explain it, and it just won't be as good as otherwise would have been. And in any event, it is unesthetic to quarrel with the witness. Since the story I just told you was not true, and it's kind of a passage of history, albeit only a poetic passage, I wish to illustrate the sixth commandment with a passage from history which is literally true. I was not there, but someone who was there told it to me, and I do believe it to be true. Perhaps you will have gathered from my discussion of the relationship between judicial notice and the scientific basis of scientific devices that I am something of a World War II buff. The aspect of World War II that I most like to read about, because after all I am also a lawyer, is the Nuremberg trial, the first one, the one of the leaders, Goering and the others. There's a vast library of stuff on it. I haven't read all of it by any means, but I enjoy reading about it. I had learned through something or other that I read that a member of the British team was an historian, not a lawyer, named John, later Sir John, Wheeler Bennett. The British government felt that it would be useful to posterity to have the notes of a professional historian whose only responsibility at Nuremberg was to sit there and observe and note down the kinds of things that an historian would note so that the local color, the flavor of it, would not disappear, you know, as time went on. Of course, you've always got the cold transcript, but still you need sort of the human part of it. Well, Sir John Wheeler Bennett sat through the entire trial. And he was an expert in European diplomatic history, as I say, not a lawyer. And I said to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a chance to talk to Sir John Wheeler Bennett? Well, I was then teaching at the New York University Law School, and one day there came across my desk a university newspaper which announced that Sir John Wheeler Bennett was going to spend the next term in residence at NYU teaching graduate students in European history. With the savoir-faire and the finesse that I know you have come to associate with me, I made it my business to get an invitation to dinner with Sir John Wheeler Bennett. And I walked in and was introduced to him, and I said, how do you do, Sir John? Please tell me about Nuremberg. And he was delighted to, and he spent the rest of the evening telling me extraordinary stories about Nuremberg, such as what happened when the two acquittals were announced. You know, two of the defendants were acquitted. But that's a story for another occasion. The one I want to tell you now illustrates this commandment of not quarreling with the witness. Sir John said perhaps the most interesting couple of hours of the trial for him was the cross-examination of Hermann Goering. Hermann Goering, who survived two of the trials, took the witness stand and testified in his own behalf. Now, Hermann Goering was apparently an extraordinarily intelligent and energetic man, a World War I flying ace. He built the Luftwaffe into a major war machine. Obviously, you know, the devil incarnate, that I'm not talking about. Towards the end of the war, he began to fall apart with narcotics and cosmetics and every other damn thing, but he pulled himself together, and there he was on the witness stand, not fighting for his life. He damn well knew that he was going to be convicted, and he damn well knew that somewhere he had those cyanide capsules hidden away, which he took the night before the morning they were going to come to hang him. But he was fighting for his place in history, and that's more important to a man like Hermann Goering. Well, Sir John Wheeler Bennett said there was Hermann Goering on the stand, and the chief prosecutor for each of the four allied nations conducted the cross-examination. And Sir John said that he, as a lawyer, had no opinion, no judgment on the technical adequacy of the cross-examination, but he was struck by how vividly each cross-examiner mirrored the national stereotype. He said the American cross-examination was done by Justice Robert Jackson, who of course was on leave from the Supreme Court to be the chief prosecutor. And Sir John said that it seemed to him that Justice Jackson was occasionally brilliant, but frequently got into trouble. And when he got into trouble, it was because he was not prepared. The British prosecutor restricted himself exclusively to bailing the American out of his trouble. Did nothing else. He said the Frenchman was charming, but wholly incompetent. It was just a laugh. Just a laugh from beginning to end. But best of all, he said, was the Russian. He said that Russian was like a 20-ton heavy tank. He said once it got clanked up, going, right? It moved inexorably forward, and nothing on earth could stop it. He said, this is how the Russian cross-examined Hermann Goering. He had Hermann Goering on the witness stand over there, and in front of the lawyer, there was a pile of documents. And of course, he did it in Russian, but you didn't have to know any Russian to get the idea, and I will do it for you in the English equivalent. This was the cross-examination by the Russian prosecutor. Hermann Goering, I hand you a document. Read it. Have you read it?
Yes.
Does it bear your signature?
Yes.
Do you now confess yourself to be a fascist beast?
No.
And he'd pick up the next document and do it again. And so on through the whole pile of documents. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that question, do you now confess yourself to be a fascist beast, is quarreling with the witness. Okay? And every time you are tempted to ask a question that has the ring of, do you now confess yourself to be a fascist beast? Don't. Remember my sixth commandment. You'll be quarreling with the witness. Avoid it. Seventh commandment. Never, never, never permit the witness to repeat on cross-examination what he said on direct examination. Indeed, that's what underlies the middle group of four modes of impeachment. You want to impeach, you want to persuade the jury that the witness is not worth repeating without letting him say it again. Why? Well, because as every trial lawyer knows, there's a kind of informal or unwritten hierarchy of probative value. If the jury hears it once, they may or may not believe it. If they hear it twice, they'll probably believe it. If they hear it three times, they'll certainly believe it. And if it's in writing, nothing on this earth will persuade them that it's not true. So, on direct examination, they hear it once. The light was green. I don't know whether your experience is the same as mine, but the typical cross-examination that I used to have to sit to listen to in that court back home in New York would go something like this. Just listen to it, right? Direct examination, the light was green. Cross-examination by a lawyer whose position is that the light was red. Always it begins this way. There are a couple of things about your direct, Mr. Witness, that are unclear. Let's clear them up. Got that? He's busy making it clear. You know, he's the cross-examiner. He says, what color was the light? Green. Are you sure? Yes. Tell the jury again. It was green. Were you wearing your glasses? Of course I was wearing my glasses. And what color was the light? Green. Do you realize you're under oath? I know I'm under oath. And the guy sits down. That's the cross-examination. What does he accomplish? The jury's heard it five times. That light is green to the end of eternity now. Right? Don't let the witness repeat. There are many other things you can do without permitting the witness to repeat. Remember that commandment. We move on to the eighth. The eighth commandment. Don't permit the witness to explain anything. Now remember, your cross-examination consists entirely and exclusively of leading questions. That's the third commandment. So all the witness is being asked is yes, no, I don't know. Yes, no, I don't know. And you've got to be alert to that yes, but. Stop! Cut him off. You didn't ask him that. Now, of course it's a ball game. Of course there's another side. Of course, the other side will always have an opportunity on redirect to bring out the explanation. You play your side of it, let them play their side of it. If it comes out on redirect, it has the smack of an afterthought. It's not as persuasive as if it comes out in the middle of the cross. And maybe the other side won't bring it out because they don't know what the explanation is, or they're asleep at the switch or something of that kind happens. And maybe the judge will interrupt and say, let him explain. Well, if the judge interrupts, there's not much you can do about it. But still, you play it the way you should play it. You conduct your cross-examination the right way, which is not permitting the witness to explain. Illustrating it, I have a splendid story. And this is almost the first time I'm telling it. I have it from the man who is the victim of it, and I have his permission to tell it. At the meeting of the American Bar Association, which took place in August, so it was, 8 weeks ago, at the annual luncheon of the litigation section, I ended up sitting next to Edward Bennett Williams, who is, I believe, in my judgment, a great trial lawyer, the best I have ever seen in action. And I was thrilled to be sitting next to him, and we're vaguely acquainted from years ago, but I really haven't had a chance to talk to him for a long time. And we got to talking about the things we've been talking about for the last couple of hours, and I asked him whether a certain rumor I had heard was true. He said it was true, and he told me the story, and then I asked him if I could use it to illustrate this commandment of not permitting the witness to explain, and he said, yes, I might. So you see, there's hope for everybody. This is Edward Bennett Williams conducting, if not his first, an early cross-examination. Williams got out of law school down in Washington, and the only job he could get, but he was delighted to have it, was trying accident cases on behalf of the Washington, D.C. Trolley Company, whatever its name was. And he just tried one case after another. And that's where he began to learn the ropes. That's where he got the 25 jury trials that you need. This case was a wrongful death action. There's no doubt the trolley car had hit this old derelict, who was a notorious habitué of the Tenderloin or Bowery section of Washington, D.C., and killed him. The defense of the trolley car company was that he was drunk at the time, so that there was contributory negligence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the difficulty was that when the police arrived, and there was no reason to think anything had happened in between, there was no bottle of whiskey on the corpse. But there was evidence as follows. This old derelict had a son, who was also a derelict, who actually was sitting on the corner half a block away and saw the accident happen. And according to an independent witness, the son got up immediately after the accident happened, walked over to the body of his father, dead or dying, leaned down and did something, and then picked himself up and walked away. Aha, said Williams. What he did was lean down and pick up the whiskey bottle because he knew that that would kill his father's, or you know, his chance for a recovery. Lo and behold, the son takes the stand. And according to Edward Bennett Williams, this is how he, Williams, cross-examined the son. Were you sitting on the corner a half a block away when your father was struck by the trolley car? Yes. Did you see your father actually struck? Yes. Did you realize at once that he was badly hurt, if not killed? Oh, sure, he was really hit bad. Did you walk over, do you hear how it's going just the way it should, leading questions, etc.? Did you walk over to where your father was lying? Yes. Did you bend down? Yes. Did you do something? Yes. All right? What should you do at that point? Stop. Stop! And argue in summation. What was he doing bending down over his father? Instead, Williams didn't. Instead, Williams said, isn't it a fact that what you did when you bent down over your father was to remove the whiskey bottle from his hand or from his pocket? Now, that's an idiotic question because you don't know what the answer is. And the answer was, no, that's not a fact, Mr. Williams. As Williams said to me at lunch 8 weeks ago, then I should have sit down. I mean, the handwriting was on the wall, but he didn't. Instead, violating this eighth commandment, never permit the witness to explain, Williams said to the witness, well, you tell the jury what you did if you didn't take the whiskey bottle out of his pocket. And the answer was, well, Mr. Williams, he may have been a drunken old bum, but he was my father. I bent down and I kissed him goodbye. Let it happen to you once and you'll never forget the eighth commandment, huh? Ninth commandment. The ninth commandment is part of the lore, L-O-R-E, of trial lawyers. Each generation passes it on to the next. I suspect illustrating it with a different version of the same apocryphal story, which doubtless can be traced ultimately to the Talmud, if not to some earlier source. This ninth commandment is avoid one question too many. So easy to say. Don't ask one question too many, but it's so hard to do. Okay? Because you'll always recognize one question too many after you've asked it. Okay? Always, always. You ask it, you no, come back, but it's too late. It's out there. And instantly it becomes the one question too many. The only way I can think of that might help you is, remember, you ask questions only to get what you need to support the summation. And the instant you're within hailing distance of having what you need, sit down, stop. Don't push it to the line, and certainly don't go over the line. The apocryphal story, which in one form or another comes down the generations, illustrating the one question too many, is this. It's apocryphal. I don't know whether it's true or not. But as it was told me, and as I tell it to you, it was a criminal case. The charge was atrocious assault in the first degree, whatever it might be called in the jurisdiction. And the theory of the prosecution was that the defendant and the victim got into a fight. In the course of the fight, the defendant got his teeth around the victim's nose and bit it clean off. Now, that can happen. You see, the teeth are like little chisels. The jaw muscle is the strongest voluntary muscle in the body and has enormous force. And the nose is just cartilage. There's no bone in there, and you can bite it off the way you can bite through the end of a steak. Well, the prosecution's case rests chiefly upon the testimony of an eyewitness who takes the stand and on direct examination says, I saw it. I saw the defendant bite off the victim's nose. I saw the defendant bite off the victim's nose. Do something. Okay, the defense counsel stands up to cross-examine. And he goes, he does a terrific job up until the end when he asks one question too many. Just listen, right? Where were they fighting? Middle of the field. What time of day or night was it? It was high noon. And where were you? I was on the edge of the field. And what were you doing there? Bird watching. Excuse me? Bird watching. Oh, you were looking at birds. Yeah. The birds were in the trees, weren't they? Yes. So you were looking at the birds in the trees. Right. And your back was to the field where these people were fighting. Isn't that right? Yes. When is the first time you knew that something was wrong? When I heard the victim scream. What do you do now? Sit down! And what do you argue? No perception! His back was to the people fighting. He doesn't know what happened! Instead, the one question too many, which also argues with the witness, which also permits the witness to explain, which is not a leading question, to which the witness doesn't know the answer, to which the lawyer doesn't know the answer, etc. Well, how come? If your back was to them because you were looking at the birds in the trees, how come you know, as you told us on direct examination, that the defendant, my client, bit off the victim's nose? How come you know that? And the famous answer was, well, I saw him spit it out. And that's the kind of answer you will get every time you ask one question too many. Well, believe it or not, that's nine. We now come to the tenth and last. Ladies and gentlemen, this tenth is my favorite, in the sense that the sickest or the weakest child is always the parent's favorite. This commandment is not sick or weak, but you will have occasion to use it perhaps once in a career. The other nine commandments you will need every time you cross-examine a witness. But the tenth commandment you will need only when you have that special case. And let me take a moment to attract your interest, you know, to present the special case to you. Now, I have only the slightest acquaintance with you. But we're all human beings. I know a little bit about human beings. I know that every one of you has an object of heart's desire. Now, I don't know specifically what it is, but I know that you have it. There is something you want in this world. You want money. You want fame. You want power. I guess that's all. Huh? Now, we're not basketball players and we're not movie stars. We're lawyers. So if you're going to get the object of your heart's desire, it's going to be through being a lawyer. And you've been sitting here listening to these lectures. I assume it's a trial lawyer that you are or want to be. What you need is the kind of case that you can try, and if you win, it will bring you the object of your heart's desire, be it money, fame, or power. And we'll assume that next week you're sitting quietly in your office, when knock, 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 you open the door, and it says, here it is, here's the case that's going to bring you the object of your heart's desire. You know at once that if you win this case, money beyond the dreams of avarice. Fame, your name will be on the headline, in the headlines 10 days in a row. Power, the State House. After the State House, who knows what, huh? Yeah, all you have to do is win it. But you know how to go about it. You prepare. You prepare, you prepare, you concentrate with the zeal of a fanatic. You put everything else out of your mind, and you realize, after you analyze the case, that everything turns upon one witness. One witness who will be called by the other side. If the jury accepts what that witness says on direct examination, you lose. But if by a skillful cross-examination you can persuade the jury that that witness is not worth believing, you win. It's as easy as that. What kind of argument do you need? You need a simple argument, a tactful argument, an argument that respects the jury's intelligence. Bang, 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 the three lights go on. You've got the argument. Now all you have to do is shape the cross-examination in accordance with the first commandment, the second, and so on through the ninth. And you've done it. You practice it in the living room, and you realize. And here's where you begin to need the tenth commandment. That argument is so subtle. That cross-examination is so clever. That as you stand there asking the questions in the courtroom, the jury is not going to understand that subtle argument, is not going to understand how clever you are being. And the temptation will be to extend the cross-examination so that the jury then and there understands what a bright boy or girl you are. Don't do it! Remember the 10th commandment. Save the point for summation. Doesn't matter that the jury doesn't understand it while you're conducting the cross-examination. All the better that they don't understand it. You know why? You want them to remember. And what is the frame of mind best calculated to bring it about that the jury remembers? What? Unsatisfied curiosity. So long as in the summation you come back and satisfy their curiosity. That trial can go on endlessly after your cross-examination. But if their curiosity is unsatisfied, they're going to be thinking about it, and they're going to remember it, and finally you tell them what it was all about in summation, and you've got them. I'll give you an example. I've already told you where I stand on Watergate, so I'll tell you that though I no longer try cases, if I did and could have my choice of one trial in the last 5 years, it would be the Washington, D.C. Watergate case, the one where everybody's getting out of jail now. Right? You know, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell. I would want to prosecute that case. You know why? Not for Haldeman and Ehrlichman. They're sons of bitches, and they admit to being sons of bitches. I don't care about that. It's John Mitchell I want. Because he's a sanctimonious son of a bitch. Remember, with the wattles swinging back and forth? He took the stand in that trial. He took the stand, and he testified for 2.5 days on direct examination. I didn't know anything. If I'd known about it, I wouldn't have done it. I would never do such a thing. Butter wouldn't melt in my mouth. You know, that kind of thing. Ooh, do I want him. And I could get him, too. And this would be the cross-examination. Right after 2.5 days of direct, remember, I'd stand up. I would say, John Mitchell, you were born on March 10th, 1912, weren't you? Yes. I have no further questions. And sit down. You got it? What's the jury saying to itself? What the hell is that all about? What's going on? What's the point? What does it mean? The trial can continue, not for another year, for another 5 years. And I can stand up in summation 5 years later. And I can say to that jury, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I know it was 5 years ago. But do you remember my one question on cross-examination of John Mitchell? Did you understand what I was getting at? Well, let me tell you what I was getting at, and you tell them. And they're 6 inches off their chairs. They run into that jury room. That's all they can talk about. They come back in a few minutes. The verdict is the one you want. The money, yours. Fame, a household word. Power, they're already playing hail to the chief. Because you remember the 10th commandment.